Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Lisa Raines, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm excited about this. I love what you're doing. I want to share with the world what you're doing. And I want to talk about it. You are starting, I would venture to say, the world's first architecture firm franchise. I've seen people attempt it in the past. I think those companies are no longer around. And so it's good to see what you're doing with Pride Road. And I'm looking forward to having a conversation and diving a little bit deeper into what you're doing and how you're doing it. Sound good?
That sounds great. Thanks for having me. I don't think I'm the first, as the first company to do it. But as you say, there doesn't seem to be anyone in the UK sort of thriving with it at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll talk about that. Let me introduce you so people know who you are. Lisa Raines is the founder of Pride Road, the architecture firm franchise, which grew out of Lisa's refusal to accept that there was only one way for a woman to have an architecture career and a family life. Lisa built her practice in the UK's domestic sector and then invested to turn her business into one that other ambitious architects wanting work-life balance could also buy into, a franchise. So I'm really excited about having this conversation and learning about the story of how Pride Road came about and how it works and how maybe our other architects in the UK and maybe even in the US might be able to work with you at Pride Road. But before we jump into that conversation, I want to learn more about you, Lisa. I want to hear your origin story. So go back as far as you want to go back. When did you discover your passion for architecture? And maybe who or what inspired you to get started?
So when I was little, my granddad was a builder, and he used to take me around building sites. In fact, he built his own home back in 1977 when I was five. And it was in the Isle of Man, and it was on the edge of a cliff.
Wow. Cool.
And it was quite a sight. I mean, it wasn't literally on the edge of a cliff. It was, but it had some significant level changes. So the front of it looked like a bungalow, and then it dropped back to reveal a two-story, nearly three-story building at the back.
Yeah.
And I remember him sort of having building a little model of it.
Designed it and built it?
He designed it and built it, yeah. And I remember going on site and helping in inverted commas, in air quotes, with some rebar scheme propping and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then I also remember him kind of like taking me to see diggers and crying.
Just afraid?
Yeah, I think I do remember being a little bit afraid of diggers when I was a toddler. So I guess I was kind of inducted into the whole world of building from being very small. Then my dad was running a builder's merchant. So I was kind of around building materials growing up. And then when it came to choosing a career, it was sort of, I was around sort of 16, and my dad sort of, we were heading into a recession. And sorry, I can just hear someone at the door. I think they've come in. Yeah, I think that's fine. Sorry, I was saying to Mark before, we're working from home, so
yeah,
it's a bit of family interruption and dogs might be barking.
It's the way life works and business works these days.
It is. Yeah. So going back, I was 16 thinking about what to study, and architecture was an option, and my dad thought it was a good career, in again in quotes, for a lady.
So was he concerned that the alternative was construction, and he thought architecture was more appropriate?
I was actually considering accountancy.
Okay.
Or actuary.
Yeah.
Or architecture, but he had this romantic notion that architecture was a good career.
Yeah.
For a lady to have that kind of,
do you think he had that thought throughout your life, that having been, you know, involved in construction and building materials and all of that, sort of had his own plans for you?
I guess he did. But I'm kind of the eldest of three kids, and my brother's got learning difficulties, he's 2 years younger. So I was kind of brought up in quite a traditional Jewish household, and I was actually the first girl in our family to go to university. So I think there was, you know, my parents probably looked at my kids and, you know, my brother, and went, you know, he's not going to be the one having a profession. So it'll be so they pushed me very much into the kind of profession, and then architecture was a good way to go. But it's not until you actually get to architecture school that you realize,
yes,
whether you like it or not,
you learn what it really is all about. Fantasy of what architecture is.
It's not until you get on those courses and realize what's involved, that you actually realize how complex it is.
Was that a good thing for you, or was that a surprise in a negative way, where it's like, oh, this is harder than I thought it was going to be?
It was hard, but I think I really enjoyed all the challenges.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, it is really like that Renaissance course where you learn a bit about everything.
Right.
You know, you have to know about history and theory and environmental and structural and economical and
everything except business.
Yes.
Which is absolutely a problem.
That is the problem. Yes.
So when you graduated university, what did you do? Where did you go? Did you go to work for a firm?
Yeah. So I worked for in Simpson, who's now Simpson Hough. So one of the kind of outstanding design-led Manchester practices. So one of, I'd say, the UK's leading sort of architectural companies. And that's really where I cut my teeth. So they helped me through my part threes, so the professional qualifications. Mm-hmm. And you know, that was kind of, it was exciting, but exhausting. It really was that kind of long hours.
Yeah.
Quite misogynistic work culture at the time.
Yeah.
And I think I burnt out during that time. So I was there for like 18 months, and there was a lot of pressure to, like, who was the first one in the morning, who was the last one home at night, who was in at the weekend. It was very competitive and not a good culture at all. And so I kind of left there to go to New York.
What did you do in New York?
I worked for a guy who had a little studio, who at the time was doing sort of high-end retail concessions in airports.
And that was in New York City?
In New York City, yeah. Yeah. Okay. So actually, it was really exciting to be in New York City, but the work was incredibly dull.
Repetitive, sort of doing the same thing.
Really repetitive, sorry? Yeah.
Repetitive.
Yeah. Yeah. Very commercial. We had a design guide that we had to follow. You know, I kind of did my drawings that just got redlined and then redlined and then redlined. And I kind of lasted about 4 or 5 months and came back to the UK.
But knowing what you're doing today, was there things that you learned through that process that it maybe not inspired, but sort of informed some of the things that you've done later with Pride Road?
No.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I've had quite a range of experiences. So after working for Simpsons, I came back, and then over in the States, I came back. I did some work at Urban Splash, which had a kind of Northwest UK developer who, were kind of doing things like when people were moving back into the city centre and converting kind of old warehouses into apartments. They were kind of the leading developers of that at the time. Now you're talking like, 25 years ago. And that was exciting. That was really exciting. We'd go into enormous kind of Yorkshire Mill buildings to see what the potential was. We'd go down to Plymouth and look at kind of historic dockyards and do master planning. I suppose that was all about conservation and kind of working with an existing
sort
building.
Of the complete opposite of what you were doing in New York City.
Yeah.
Right. Because New York City was very repetitive, smaller commercial work. Now you're doing, taking old buildings, converting them, reinventing them, totally custom every single one of them. Yeah. Very interesting. The big change.
Yeah, but then, kind of I learned about the value of every square inch, centimeter, and it was all about maximizing space for commercial benefit. So I think I learned a lot of, between there and Simpsons, learned a lot of skills around functional design and just ergonomics, and which I think is absolutely that's what I use. That is definitely what I use now.
Yeah.
To help. But what I do now is completely different. It's the other end of the scale. I work with individuals on their homes. So instead of creating apartment buildings for 100 people or 100 families and who you'll never know, I might work on 100 projects, but with individuals each within that. And so I'm using the same skills, but then there's the kind of human relationship within that. And that's what I love.
Yeah. And so talk about what you do not at the franchise side, but for your own practice. What type of work do you do? And so you're doing residential work with homes and families. So it's additions and alterations, or is it new homes?
Just additions and alterations.
Okay.
We've really niched down to renovations, and that's it. We don't do new builds.
Yeah.
Or we don't do multiples. We don't do HMOs. We don't do commercial. We don't do high rises. It is just alterations and extensions.
And addition. So niching down to that level of focus where you do residential work, additions and alterations only. how intentional was that? When and why did you choose to do that and not sort of do everything for everybody?
When I first set up on my own back in end of 2010, so having had this sort of chasing this career of design-led practices and potentially wanting to run my own, you know, climb up to director level or whatever, and being kind of having the door slammed in my face, I ended up being forced to set up on my own out of necessity, because at the time it was post-financial crash. I'd had my third child. I was the breadwinner in my family. I had to get out there earning, but 50% of all architects had lost their jobs.
Yeah.
And so it was like, right, go out, find work, make it work. And to start off with, I was like, yeah, I'll do anything, you know, I'll, and then you kind of try and work, you try and do what you'd been doing. So, you know, master planning and commercial.
Right.
And I'd started doing a little bit of working with homeowners, you know, because then I'd got, oh, you're an architect, you can do my extension.
Right.
And then I did a bit of soul searching, you know, what do I want to do? And that was, well, you know, I'd like to do social housing. I don't know if the terminology is the same in the States.
What is social housing?
So it's affordable housing.
Okay.
It's working for housing associations and councils and governments.
Yeah.
You know, sort of trying to, and the idea was just trying to help.
Right. People,
but from the kind of government side. And I spent a long time trying to break into that market. I spent 2 years of chasing my tail trying to break in, and it was a closed shop.
Mm-hmm.
For a one-man band with no kind of financial background. And once I'd started doing some larger scale work for NHS estates. So that's our National Health Service estates. And I started finding that their payment terms were ridiculous. It was 90-day payments. And so if you're doing a big project with a 90-day payment, you know, you've got cash flow issues.
Right. Yeah. You're doing a whole lot of work and not getting paid for it for months.
Yeah. So, you know, the one kind of working for a homeowner turned into two, turned into three. And then I started realizing that actually working with homeowners was more dependable in term and more sustainable on as a business than work, you know, working your butt off for a large project and getting badly paid for it.
Yeah. You have more control.
More control. If there's a bad debt, you know, it's a small amount, rather, right. You know, it's a small part of your business rather than, you know, your main income. You can sort of put 7-day payment terms. So, you know, you get paid better. The work is more predictable. You're not having to, you know, each time you approach a different project, you've got the same legislation and regulation, so the same codes and zones or whatever to deal with.
You become much more effective and more efficient with the work that you do because you become an expert at that type of work.
That's right. So even though, you know, there's always new codes, new legislation coming through, so you know, we learn about them and adapt, but you're not, you know, sort of having to, if you're jumping from schoolwork to university work to hospitals, you know, each time you hit a project, there's new codes.
Right. And you need to know all of them if you're doing all that type of work.
Yeah. Whereas with this, you know, it's just one set of changes, you know, and there's a lot of, I thought I would get, you know, bored by doing one type or one style or one typology, but you don't, because each client's different, each project different, each council, geographical area, site is different. And it's the joy in those little things that and helping people make it worthwhile.
Yeah. It's the market that I built my business with as well. And so I recognize all of those things that you're talking about. And for very similar reasons, I like having the control and being to be able to affect a family's life, right? That every work, that every job that we do as residential architects have direct impact on the lives of the people that we work with, as most architects do. But we see it in very clear examples, right? And as our projects are finished, you can see how we've affected those people. How long did you have your own firm working, doing your own thing before the idea of the franchise came around? What was the inspiration to go from just another successful architecture firm to helping other architects become more successful?
Well, I think it was it was 2 years into the business when I was niching down into the residential. And then I'd found this way of working, which involved doing this a hand-drawn concept design workshop. So a kind of big issue that I'd had was convincing clients to, you know, move forward with us without them committing a huge amount of money. So you're not going to do anything speculative, and, you know, you get caught between not with overproducing or doing speculative work, whereas the concept design workshop, it's we do a hand-drawn set of drawings in front of our clients within a half day or a full day, and it's a paid piece of work. So, you know, it's £450, probably equivalent in dollars or a bit more, for a half day, and 600 for a full day.
Interesting. So they sign up, you go to their house.
Yes.
With your sketch pad and trace paper and your pens.
Yep.
Go through a process of conversation and understanding of what they want to do.
Yep.
And essentially do the concept design right there in front of them.
Yes, that's it.
Interesting. Because I've always looked at that first phase, and the ability to sketch, right? To be able to sketch and take ideas and put them on paper in front of clients is magical, right? The clients look at that and are amazed that you can do that. Yeah. We as architects take it for granted that we can take ideas from our head and draw them on a piece of paper. For clients who can't do that or haven't seen people do that, we literally look like magicians. So that's a very effective way to show your value very quickly right there in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great idea.
So we start with a free 1 hour initial consultation, which we'll do online to start off with, where we'll talk through the process and then give the client the range of fees for kind of going forward. But, you know, before they commit to their, you know, the full works and, you know, cadding up and
gives them a low friction, almost fun process to go through and pay you.
Yes.
To get them excited to go to the next step.
Exactly. And so doing that process, you solidify the client's brief. We do an optioneering, we help them to do an optioneering exercise. So we might give them, you know, sort of three options for a ground floor and three options for a first floor. So it might be, you know, option one, and then on the back of those, we ask them to do three things with them. We ask them to speak to builders, contractors to get an idea of cost, speak to estate agents, is that realtors?
Yes, realtors,
to get an idea of value, and speak to neighbours to see if there's any showstoppers, because quite often in this country, our houses are attached to one another, either in a terrace or a semi-detached house.
Yeah.
But they're not on plots with land around them.
Right. So you want to make sure that your neighbors are on board with your idea.
Yes. Yes. Because otherwise it gets really expensive.
Yeah. Yeah.
And very time consuming. And then we get the clients to feed back that information to us. So we let the clients do that. They do their own finding. And if they decide they want a three-story tower on the back that's going to cost them £200,000 or $200,000, and it's, you know, it's only going to add on £50,000 worth of value.
Right. They've done their own calculation to determine whether they want to go forward or not.
Yeah. And they're the ones that work it out, not us.
Right.
Then they're committed. So they do that. So by giving the clients the drawing, so they can see your value, they can see that you can draw, and you work through all the ideas as well. So we rarely change layouts at a later stage. So there's, you know, we don't often get, you know, people on clients on site going, oh, I didn't realize this room was going to be
right. You've done the work up front.
Yeah, they can process it really well. So there's less changes later on. They pay you. So you set up the payment technique. So, you know, we set up, you set up as a payee on their bank feed. So it's easy for them to pay.
Yeah.
On later projects or, you know, later stages.
You train them to pay you.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And also you've got a set of drawings that are good to brief the rest of your team.
Yeah. Yeah. Great idea. So you developed that process for your firm.
Yeah.
Is that how that works?
Yes.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. Accurate data is crucial, especially in today's business environment. Outdated and inaccurate data leads to turnarounds, delays, and rising costs. With supply chain and staffing issues, these costs and delays can multiply. That's why a resource like RCAT.com is so important. RCAT works with manufacturers to keep their data up to date and accurate, and offers it to you easily, accessible, and free. Use RCAT's powerful search engine to find what you need fast and download it right there on their site without needing to pay for anything. It's free. So go try RCAT.com today. That's ARCAT.com. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community.
And so once I've realized that, for me, it's a numbers game. So I need to see a certain amount of clients before I get a conversion to workshops. So that's going to change depending on the economical climate at the moment. You know, it's the conversion rates are lower, higher, whatever, because it's, you know, it's a bit tough out there. So, you know, once I've seen, say, 15 clients at a prospect stage, the free initial consultation, I might get 5 that decide to sign up for workshops. And then I know that from those 5 workshops, I might get 2.5 projects.
Right.
And so you know your numbers.
So you're tracking your success. So you're building a metric that you can follow. So a key performance indicator, KPI.
Yes.
I know that if I do 15, I'm going to get 5, which are going to result in 2, because over time you've tracked how that works. Which then now you said it's a numbers game. So now you can say, okay, well, I need 2 projects. I know I need to talk to 15 people.
Mm-hmm. That's
very
right.
Interesting. Yeah.
So, so I knew once I'd kind of got that in, and that I could see all of those people in, you know, a working day, or I could do it around, you know, a calendar, you know, where I was collecting kids or taking school holidays.
Right, more flexibility.
Once you know that you can fit in those appointments into your diary, I knew that I'd got a solution for, you know, working sort of female architects or sort of parent architects or any architects that want a bit of flexibility or need that bit of flexibility.
Which is everyone.
Yes.
Right. Everyone wants control of their own lives and flexibility. Yeah. And yeah. and the model that you just described, especially having your own firm, you have the ability to design your own business and to yeah. and to create a system like that that allows you to do the other things that are important in your life.
Yes, absolutely. And now, and then I've systemized everything.
Right. So it's all documented and developed into processes. You have it in a manual. You have it in a...
Yes. Yeah, we've got an operations manual, but also we've got a very slick CRM system that processes clients and, you know, scheduling system.
And is that something that you built custom for your firm, or are you using a product for that?
No, I'm just using Zoho.
Zoho, okay.
But it did take, you know, yeah. 2-3 years to build it for us.
Sure, sure. It still needs to be developed into a concept yeah. that works.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And there's a bit of extra code in there to make it look pretty.
So where along the line did the idea to work with other architects come in?
So I think back in 2012, so I set up around 2010. In 2012, I was chair of Women in Property Northwest, and I could see, we started looking at the numbers of kind of women in the property industry sort of going in to train and then numbers just falling off.
Right.
Yes. Of over age. And I could see that there were kind of issues. And also I was on the RIBA council, national council from 2015 to 2018. So at the time it was something like 17.5% of the RIBA database were female, but it was 50-50 entry into architecture school.
Right.
You've got a massive discrepancy. And I'd kind of found this business that would work for, offer that flexible support. And so, you know, I thought I just wanted to get it out there somehow. And I was reading business books. And I was reading Michael Gerber's E-Myth Revisited. Sure.
Yeah. One of my favorites.
Yeah. And he talks about franchising.
Yeah. So was that the inspiration? You mm-hmm. built the systems, you had it all there reading the book and you're like, wow.
Yeah. What I thought was, if I set up my business as if I'm going to franchise it, set up systems, if I don't franchise it, I've got a really robust system.
Right. Which is that's the concept of the book, right? He's not really mm-hmm. proposing that you develop a franchise model. He's proposing. Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying is that the book, I just for the listeners, the book is not necessarily, you know, saying that you should take your business and franchise it. It's saying build a business that can be franchised, right?
Yeah.
Right. And so that's what you did. You built an architecture firm with the idea that it could be franchised. You built all the systems and the processes and the checklists and all the things that you need in order to run and confirm a successful business, and then realized that, well, here it is. It's working. Why not franchise it? Is that what happened?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I kind of thought, you know, let's go down the franchise route and see what happens. And I looked into it and set it up to franchise. You know, it. I think one of the first things that I did was rebranded. So when I set up back in 2010, you know, I kind of practiced under the name Raines Architecture.
Yeah.
So that's my name. Well, actually, it was my father's name because I was married at the time, using a different name. But Raines was always the name that I'd studied under and I'd worked under. So that's what people knew.
Yeah.
But I thought, you know, I realized that if I was going to scale, then actually using my personal name wouldn't necessarily relate to anyone.
Right.
And so that's where we went through a marketing and branding exercise and came up with Pride Road. And when I say we, I went externally to a marketing company.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause even though as architects, we think we can do everything.
Yeah, right. Yes. Right.
it's important to realize that we can signpost.
Right, right.
And that actually, you know, if you need expert advice, you go to experts. So I went to a marketing expert.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a great name. It's a great brand. How does the model work today?
So we are, we have a central office, which is essentially me up in Manchester, supporting five franchisees around the UK. So we span England at the moment. So there's two in the northwest, there's one on the south coast, there's one in London, and there's one in near Birmingham. So it is really a good span. The model is set up at the moment to be UK wide, so we can very easily sort of go up to Scotland or Wales or Northern Ireland. I've split the country into 155 territories.
Okay.
So a potential franchisee would buy a territory. At the moment, the RRP is about £10,000 to buy the license to trade as Pride Road in a certain territory. And they get access to about 70,000 owner-occupier households within that territory. And so that's what works to produce those numbers that are sustainable and will provide an income. So you would sign up for 5 years. We'd have a franchise agreement. You would have an operations manual. You would have bought the license to trade as Pride Road in, say, Wiltshire or Southern Wiltshire or whatever we decide the territory name is best calling itself.
So they're all individual businesses running.
Yes. So it would be Mark LePage Limited trading as Pride Road Bath.
Got it. Okay.
So it's your company with your own PI, your own professional indemnity insurance, but you're trading as Pride Road Bath. So, and we have a central website, Pride Road, with individual locations. So everyone benefits from a shared portfolio.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So when you set up on your own, you know, and say you've been working in a commercial practice doing kind of cladding design or, you know, fenestration or whatever, you don't have a portfolio that necessarily relates to, you know, a residential homeowner. So you've got access to the shared portfolio, all the graphics. We do professional photographs, you know, you can showcase the concept design workshop.
Do you do marketing beyond the website?
Oh yes, absolutely. So we do Facebook, Instagram, some LinkedIn, some Twitter, some TikTok.
Yeah, for sure. Well, there are clients there. A lot of clients there.
Yeah.
The whole world is on TikTok.
Yeah. Podcasts.
Yeah. So when you do that, you're promoting Pride Road as a brand.
Yes.
And that benefits everybody.
Yes. Yes. One thing that I'm about to do, we're about to launch a national TV advertising campaign.
That's exciting.
It's really exciting.
Yeah.
We're running it on Sky TV. It's called Sky TV AdSmart. So one of the benefits of being a franchisee is access into like this joint kind of marketing pool and resources. You know, we can pool our money, our marketing budget, and, you know, do something so much bigger. So you can create a video for a TV commercial.
Right. Is there cost to the franchisees beyond the £10,000 initial payment?
Yes, there is. There is £150 marketing levy paid on a monthly basis, and 10% of the turnover on a monthly basis.
So 150 pounds plus 10% of revenue.
Yeah.
Got it.
So, you know, it's. And you've got to work it out. You've got to work it out financially. You know, when you come, well, as you are onboarding, you know, we do due diligence and, you know, we ask our franchisees to prepare a business plan and look at those cash flows.
So you're interviewing your franchisees as much as they're interviewing you. You want to make sure that the people who are representing Pride Road are going to be successful architects and successful business people. And so you're checking all that.
Yes. Yes. As much as we can.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you have plans to go outside of the UK?
Well, I'd love to. The way that we'd look at it internationally is to partner up with a master franchisor to cover, so whether it's Australia or the US or a state in the US, you know, we'd be looking at a master franchisor. So who would then, you know, sort of offer
someone who would take on your role in another location. Then you can, so a hub, or you essentially are the hub in the UK, and then you have franchisees. You would need another hub in Texas in order to cover Texas.
Yeah, so, because your legislation's different to ours.
Right.
I couldn't say, you know, here, this is our process. We do, you know, concept design workshops. We then do planning. We then do building, whereas you can't just take that because you're codes are and zoning are different. In fact, yours are different state to state.
Right.
So
Yeah. Interesting. I also noticed that all your franchisees are women. I'm assuming that's intentional. Is that a requirement?
No, it's not. It's not a requirement. You know, the we are family friendly, we are flexible, which would work, you know, across genders.
So what does the future look like? I know that, you know, there's a possibility that you may expand beyond the UK, which we just talked about. Is what do you sort of hope that the next 3 to 5 years looks like for Pride Road?
3 to 5 years, I think, growing our franchise base in the UK. You know, I'd like to see sort of 10, 15, 20 franchisees in the next 3 to 5 years. Maybe that's too optimistic, but certainly growth. And, you know, maybe I'd be talking to, you know, someone in the States.
Yeah. Well, somebody listening right now might be interested in that. So, if they are, how do they connect with you? If somebody's interested in doing something with you here in the United States.
Well, if they were to come on the, have a look at the Pride Road franchise website, then my details are at the bottom. So they can.
Okay, great. It's prideroadfranchise.co.uk is the franchise website.
Yeah.
We'll have a link to that on the show notes. I'll repeat it again at the end. Lisa, you have a great story and very inspiring, some great ideas as well. So even if you're not going to franchise, the things that you've done are things that every architect should be doing, you know, developing a system that works, right? That potentially could be franchised. That's the concept, right? And I highly recommend The E-Myth Revisited by Michael Gerber. Every architect should read that book. And if you're questioning, should you read the original or read the architect one? Read the original. Read the original first. If you want to read the architect one, that's fine as well. Norbert is a great writer and has great ideas. He's been on the show as well. But the original is the one that will inspire you, that will share the ideas of what Michael originally talked about. And so read that book. Every architect should read that book. Before we wrap things up, Lisa, what is your thought on what's one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
So I think it's just about niching down and just really kind of looking at what you either are good at or want to do. So you may not be the best, you know, sort of elderly care designer now, but you may want to be there. So that's something you want to aspire towards, and then concentrate on it, become an expert in that, you know, do your research, attend conferences, talk at conferences, and then, you know, you will attract clients to that.
Yeah.
Great advice. I would say, I'd say niche.
Yeah.
Try not to be a jack of all trades and master of none.
Yeah. And that's hard for a lot of architects. Architects want to help the world, and they want to do all different things and have experience and explore all these different ways. But in order to be successful in business, you need to niche down.
I would say just watch the climate as well, the economic climate, because, you know, a certain type of architectural work may boom in 2023, but in, you know, 2025, will all the funding be cut for it?
Right, right. Yep.
So, you know, you do need to have a look at the historical patterns around it.
Yeah. Look ahead, look behind, and then niche down and go for it. Become an expert. Great advice. Lisa Raines is her name. The company is Pride Road, like a lion, Pride Road. If you'd like to learn more about the franchise opportunity, the website is prideroadfranchise.co.uk. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. If you want to see the client-facing website, that's prideroad.co.uk. So Pride Road without the franchise, prideroad.co.uk. Lisa, thank you. Thank you for doing what you're doing. It's inspiring to hear your story. It's motivational to hear the systems that you've built. Architects all should be developing systems for their business to become more successful, but not only successful, but to have that freedom and control that you'd like. Go ahead.
Sorry, I completely forgot. You can also listen to me on my podcast. Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah, absolutely. What's the name of the podcast?
There is the Pride Road Architects podcast.
All right. We'll have a link to that on the show notes as well. The Pride Road Architect podcast. Excellent. Excellent. Thank you. Thank you for all you're doing. I appreciate you for coming by here, sharing your story, talking about Pride Road, and inspiring us. Thanks for being here at Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a rating, write a review, and share a link to this episode with a friend. I know I say this every episode, but I'd really love for you to send me some feedback. Share a rating, write a review, however you want to do that. And please share a link to this episode with a friend. Just send it off in an email. Say, hey, take a listen to this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, because that is how Entree Architect has grown to serve thousands more architects just like you. I appreciate it. Share a rating, write a review, and share a link to this episode with a friend. Thank you to all our sponsors for this episode. Links to all our sponsors and all the resources that we discussed today in this episode are available at the show notes for this episode, and all the episodes can be found at entrearchitect.com/podcast. entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. That's the media network that's dedicated to architects, engineers, and construction pros. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com. If you like this podcast, if you like Entree Architect Podcast, I think you'll love all the podcasts at Gable Media. Go check them out at gablemedia.com. My name is Mark Arla Page. Thank you for listening to this episode of Entree Architect Podcast. I appreciate you. Love, learn, and share what you know.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns. What's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.